You say you did it. I say you didn't. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. I say you got lucky. You say I didn't try. So you say it all worked. I say not for me. You say I didn't try. I say you just don't see why. You say I didn't try. I ask, can't you cry? You ask, why should I? I ask as I sigh. Why can't you see it? If we exist as I, too few will make it if we are only I. Folks, that's the whole question in life is how much do we care about others and how much do we sacrifice a little bit to make our world a better place? We're going to talk about all kinds of issues on this show. This is the Lehigh Valley Discourse and WDIY, and I'm your host, Alan Jennings. And that would be me. As y'all know, I've been trying to fight poverty for almost 40 years. During that time, we've created programs like the Second Harvest Food Bank and the Sixth Street Shelter. We've weatherized tens of thousands of homes. We've helped thousands of people buy their first home. We saved 1,200 families from foreclosure. We put people in jail for a massive mortgage fraud conspiracy, challenged realtors to adhere to fair housing laws. And tonight I have two prominent anti-poverty activists, people who do this work at the national level, who fight these issues every day with and for us. They are the CEOs of national organizations with networks of members. Both have played a key role in our ability to do what we've done. First is the CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. I was a board member of NCRC for nearly 10 years, and I'm very proud of that service. NCRC works to ensure that lower-income people in their neighborhoods have access to capital, which is the lifeblood of a market economy. Those of you who are familiar with my work know that I've held the bank's feet to the fire, making sure that credit flows to places it never had. And the reason we have the power to do that is a federal law called the Community Reinvestment Act. And the people defending and promoting that law every day is the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, headed by Jesse Van Tol. Jesse, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Jesse's, Jesse, I think you took over as CEO of NCRC when you were about 12, right? I was just so impressed, and your speeches that I've heard, you know, at the national conferences have been phenomenal. Jesse's work includes $90 billion worth of community benefits agreements with banks during the merger process. That's a very, very careful two-step to pull that off. Jesse's also on the Consumer Advisory Council of the Federal Reserve, as well as the Affordable Housing Advisory Councils for both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So Jesse's in the middle of the fray. Your $90 billion worth of community benefits agreements, how does the CRA give you the leverage to pull that off? How does that work?
So the Community Reinvestment Act is this remarkable law passed in 1977. And what it says is, it says that banks have an affirmative obligation to invest in low and moderate income communities. And it's unique in that sense because of the word affirmative. There are a lot of laws in this country about what you cannot do. You know, when it comes to banking law, there are a lot of consumer protection laws that say you're not allowed to treat people a certain way. There are things that have been outlawed because they're abusive to consumers. This law, the Community Reinvestment Act, or CRA, says you must do good things. It has this affirmative obligation for banks to invest in the communities that they're otherwise doing business with, to address the needs of, in particular, low and moderate income communities who otherwise can get passed by banking institutions. And so, part of the reason we're able to use the law and use the law so effectively is this framework around an affirmative obligation. And the framework also has another critical component, and that's that in determining the convenience and needs of low and moderate communities, that's part of the language of the law, that banks have to serve those convenience and needs. You have to rely on the community to say what those things are. And so the law doesn't allow for banks to just say, well, we think we should do X, Y, and Z. But it actually has this engagement process to engage the community in determining what those needs are. And so what we do, to put that all together, we work with our members around the country. Alan, you mentioned being a member, but it's, you know, it's local organizations like community action agencies, you know, housing groups, economic development groups. We work with local organizations as part of our membership to determine and assess and analyze and present what those needs are. And we approach the banks with that, and we say, this is what the community has identified as an issue of critical concern, and we ask, you know, banks to step up in a leadership way in addressing those concerns. And we use CRA. CRA can be a very powerful force at the time of a bank merger or acquisition. It can be a very powerful force when banks are going through their CRA exam. Banks care about this because it is the law. They're required to do it, and if they don't do it and don't engage with the community, you know, there can be pretty significant consequences. You know, a merger might not go through. They might fail their CRA exam, and these things, you know, are, insofar as they're built into the law as a penalty, as a consequence, pretty significant.
So they get a rating on how well they do that, and that rating is public information. So consumers can make a decision on where to bank based on whether or not the bank that they are putting their money into is reinvesting in their community, right?
That's right. So banks get examined every 3 years or so under CRA, and they get a score, a ranking, ranging from outstanding to satisfactory. It needs to improve. That's a failing grade or substantial noncompliance. And anybody can get a hold of that exam. You can actually walk into any branch and ask for it, and the bank's supposed to provide it to you. You can also visit our website, ncrc.org, and contact us, and we can help you find that exam. But banks do care about this. It's part of their reputation. And a good CRA score is part of what a good bank should do and should be earning to demonstrate that, you know, they have the you know, sort of good housekeeping seal of approval when it comes to investing in communities. And individuals, cities and towns, institutions, you know, we do encourage people to determine who they bank with, in part based on how well that bank is doing at serving community needs. And, you know, CRA score is a pretty significant factor in looking at that.
I've done about 10 or 12 community benefits agreements here at the local level in Lehigh Valley. And one of the things that's a little frustrating is that those agreements don't really have any legal standing, really. There's the examinations that the regulators do of the banks don't factor that in. So how is it that how do we know the banks are doing what they've agreed to do?
Yeah, sure. And you know, first of all, you're right. Historically, bank regulators have not considered community benefits agreements with groups to be binding or to be part of the official CRA record. Although I think that the tide is turning on that. We have successfully managed to get a number of our agreements referenced in bank merger approvals.
Really?
Submitted for the record as part of the approval, and submitted for the record as part of you know, a CRA exam process. And so we've made some progress with the regulators on that front. But, you know, we rely on building a community base and building into our community benefits agreements some monitoring of bank performance to say, you know, tell us what you've done in fulfillment of this agreement, and we want to share that with the community. The real power of CRA is in the ability of people to come together and raise concerns with the bank, to have some power in that process. With some regulatory leverage, and so CRA has always required organizing, has always required concerned people, concerned organizations to come together to hold banks accountable, and you know, so that's part of the process to build those kinds of coalitions that are required to raise those issues, to follow up, to keep a watchful eye on what banks are doing to fulfill their obligations. And, you know, there we have a long way to go, Alan. I mean, I think that I'm the CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, and yet if, you know, when I travel the country, when I talk about CRA, there are a lot of people who don't know that it exists, including people in our field. And that's part of our challenge, part of our obligation, is to educate people and build the circle of people who know what it is, who are involved and engaged.
I've characterized the law as taking the stuffiest industry in America and make it beholden to radicals like me. I consider it to be the most, perhaps the most powerful anti-poverty tool in the toolbox. But it's under threat now, probably predictably, by the Trump administration.
That's exactly right. So the head of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, one of three main banking regulatory agencies, who's a Trump appointee, Joseph Otting, came into the office saying he was going to reform CRA and has proposed a series of changes to the law that would really gut its effectiveness, and in particular minimize the ability of community-based organizations to really have an impact, but also would really dramatically change what CRA is about. You know, CRA today is all about encouraging banks to make small business loans and loans for home ownership to people who otherwise might be left out or who might have a difficult time getting a loan. It's about investing in affordable housing. It's about investing in community development more broadly. And the proposed changes to the law would dramatically change the incentives to encourage banks to invest in really high-dollar projects that they make a lot of money at. So in particular, the proposal would allow banks to claim credit on their CRA exams for investing in bridges and roads and highways and other types of infrastructure that are, you know, perhaps a good thing to do. We certainly need bridges and roads, but that don't necessarily need the unique incentive that CRA offers. These are projects that happen regardless. These are projects that banks make a fair amount of money doing. CRA was designed to certainly not to force banks to do anything that was unprofitable or that they lost money at or that would threaten their safety and soundness, but it was designed to do some things that might not be as profitable, that might not happen but for CRA. And in general, the thrust of the reform changes proposed by Comptroller Otting and accepted and signed on to by the chair of the FDIC, Yelena McWilliams, would move CRA in a direction in which banks are motivated to invest in very large projects, projects that are really happening anyway.
And then they wouldn't have to invest in those pesky little communities, right?
No, you know, it really allows banks to ignore certain communities, to ignore smaller projects, to not partner with smaller community-based organizations. I think it will really incent banks to work with a small number of probably national intermediary-type organizations who they can park a bunch of money in and do some very large projects, but doesn't really require them in the same way to be very responsive to very localized needs, to look at the needs of every place. And the needs in the Lehigh Valley will be very different than the needs in, you know, Washington, D.C. or New York City. And the new proposal allows banks to really run up the total for CRA credit, either in a very big place or even not in a big place, but where they can make significant profits off of investing in large projects.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, the Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guest tonight is Jesse Van Tol, the CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, a group that challenges our community to do better by putting credit into low-income communities and invest in low-income people, and he's done a hell of a job out of it. Jesse, it would be remiss if we talk about public affairs and not talk about COVID and its effect on what we do. You guys have been raising this issue What are you saying about COVID and community reinvestment issues?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, COVID-19 reveals something that I think many of us already knew, which is that there are a great number of people in this country, a great number of communities that are economically vulnerable. And I think we're now weeks, months into the crisis. I think even very early on, 2 weeks into the crisis, 2 weeks into stay-at-home orders, and the United States Congress had to act to pass one, if not the largest, very close to the largest stimulus package in the history of the country. We're looking at employment now that rivals the Great Depression, that certainly is the second biggest since the Great Depression, 15% or greater at this point in time, and likely to grow ongoing. And so fundamentally, we have an economy that is often touted as the greatest economy in the world, and yet is very fragile. And that 2 weeks without work, and we need to intervene in a very significant way to make sure that people can eat, people can stay in their homes, and that the economy doesn't collapse completely. And fundamentally, that starts with individuals, with low-income people, low-wealth people, who just have no savings, who are really vulnerable to economic disruption. So I think that COVID really reveals a major weakness in our economy, that the fact that there are a large group of people who are not doing that well, even in strong times, and that are immediately doing poorly when the economy has a recession, should be very concerning for everyone. It should be very concerning about the future of the country. It also reveals, Alan, there's private assets, there's the savings that people have, there's the wealth that people have accumulated. There's also public assets. And I think the crisis also reveals that public assets are very weak and not evenly distributed. About healthcare, and I think about the delivery systems and mechanisms that we have in this country. We're seeing the effect of having a national healthcare system that is more and more privatized all the time. You've got hospitals laying people off because they're owned by private equity companies, and they're looking at the bottom line and saying it's not profitable to keep employing people. In the midst of perhaps the biggest health crisis this country has ever known.
Right.
And so when we look at public assets, at those kinds of things that in this moment people need to be able to rely on for their health and well-being, and we see there too a state of weaker than desirable public assets and public assets that are not evenly shared. And I'm including in public assets the ability to quickly manufacture and distribute essential medical goods and supplies, kind of protective equipment that was needed in this crisis and that has come slowly and too late in many cases.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse, WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guest, Jesse Van Tol, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Jesse, Washington has spent a couple trillion or a few trillion dollars already trying to fix the economy. How would you rate the stimulus and its effectiveness, its success?
I think there's kind of three factors to consider: speed, size, and then the quality of the impact. And I think certainly lawmakers acted very quickly with a very big package. The downside of that, as we have seen, is when you use a blunt instrument, you tend to have blunt effects. And there are a great many people left behind or not helped that much by the stimulus. Remember, the direct payments to American workers were for some people just a few weeks of relief in a crisis that is now going on months. And as we see, 15% of people unemployed. The pain and the hurt is very deep in communities. We see programs like the Payroll Protection Program, PPP,
right,
in which billions of dollars were pushed out the door, and yet, as people pause to reflect, it's very clear that in some cases, some very big companies got what amounts to free money, companies that have millions of dollars in net profits in years past, that have market capitalizations well into the millions, that are clearly, they may be suffering with the rest of us in the sense that their businesses are shut down at the moment, but their underlying financial health is pretty strong. And so we need to, as we look at future rounds of stimulus, think about more targeted impact. Think about the smallest businesses.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
Some of whom have not gotten helped. Think about the people directly impacted who are unemployed. Think about particular populations that have been very hard hit. There's been a lot of press about the disproportionate impact this has had on African Americans, both in terms of health, but also a lot of small businesses and communities of color led by people of color have been strongly impacted, but they're the least likely to have been helped. We know 96% of black businesses, for example, have no employees. They're their sole proprietors.
Microenterprises.
Something else. And microenterprises, and those are the businesses that have the hardest time accessing PPP funds because it's complicated and you're better positioned to do it if you're a business that has a chief financial officer and a lawyer and people to help put together the application, a banking relationship. If you didn't have those things, it's much tougher, and we need to make sure that those businesses, that those people hardest hit by this, that we target the relief as much as possible while also keeping the program fast moving and making sure that we sort of get the money out the door as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I think this, when all is said and done, it's going to widen the disparity of wealth between people of color and their white counterparts because, as you said, they're smaller, in most cases tiny businesses, have no idea how to apply for this stuff. And groups like ours that do small business development weren't really let in on the opportunity. And I think that whatever other stimulus comes along has got to provide support for community development financial institutions that are on the street making loans to people who are not getting cut in on this. And you ought to sic NCRC on the Congress on that issue, Jesse.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. You know, I think the future stimulus needs to devote certainly PPP funds exclusively to CDFIs and to all CDFIs, not lumping CDFIs in with other community banks for a set-aside, but creating a unique pool for CDFIs and letting more CDFIs into the program. I think it also needs to have some targeting based on loan size or business size so that we ensure that the smallest businesses get served. And I think CDFIs will tend to do that, but I think it's also a good thing to make sure that we set aside some portion of the funds to help those really small businesses that have been the last to be helped and maybe the slowest to come back.
If they come back.
Fail if they come back, exactly.
Yeah. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. On the phone with me is Jesse Van Tol, CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, which has been holding the bank's feet to the fire for, what, 30, almost 40 years. It's always good to give people like an assignment. If people were to ask you, what can we do, just as regular folks, what would you suggest people do to take action in support of the kinds of things that you and I are doing out there?
I always encourage people to do anything they can, and I think all too often we get sort of a general instructions, contact your member of Congress. I think that's a good thing to do. I always tell people, join something. You need to be a part of something, and whether it's the National Community Reinvestment Coalition or your organization or local organization, be supportive of those organizations that are standing up and fighting for this kind of thing and become a part of something. It is in groups that we can have a powerful impact. I'd encourage people to comment on the CRA proposal, but the comment period is closed. But people can certainly find out more about that at ncrc.org/treasurecra and sign up to get emails and action alerts around what future actions may be necessary. I would encourage people to contact their member of Congress, let them know how important it is that we keep stimulus dollars flowing, that we target them to the hardest hit, that we incorporate and include community institutions like CDFIs, future rounds of funding.
I'm thrilled to be able to have you on the show tonight. I hope that you're going to be able to have your annual conference. It's always such a powerful experience. the law is such a powerful tool. It's why it's under attack. And my understanding is you're trying now to get Congress to block anything OCC tries to do. Is that the angle we're taking now?
Yeah, I think there are several angles. First of all, they haven't finalized the rule, and we'll continue to put pressure on them to not do that or to make some significant changes. But yes, we're encouraging people to weigh in with their members of Congress to let the OCC and the FDIC know that, first of all, now is not the time to make changes to a law that weakens its impact,
right.
That if anything, a stronger law is more needed than ever before. But that it's the wrong time to make changes, period, that there are other more urgent, more critical things in the short term. And so we're encouraging people to contact their member of Congress and tell them that and urge them to urge the OCC and the FDIC to slow down and to pause the rule.
Jesse Van Tol, thanks for your time this evening. Appreciate it very much. Thanks for the good work you're doing. Thanks for the help that you give me to make the Lehigh Valley a better place.
And thank you, Alan, for your leadership. You've been a stalwart for us for decades, part of the coalition, and your work is very meaningful and impactful, and we're honored to be associated.
Thanks, Jesse. Appreciate that. Next up, David Bradley, the National Community Action Foundation, probably the single person most able to be credited for the Community Action Committee of the Lehigh Valley being in business today. Stay with us.
This is Operations Director Neil Heaver. Healthcare workers around the nation are bravely battling the COVID-19 virus, and we all need to do our part to help. Many of the real voices you know at WDIY will be absent this spring as they heed the call to stay home and stay safe. Our staff and volunteers have faced challenges before, and I'm certain we'll get through this crisis. We'll continue to provide NPR news and a variety of music, and we will bring the many choices and real voices back as soon as possible. Our best wishes to you and your loved ones, and thank you for listening and supporting us at WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. Tonight, second half of the show, I have the pleasure of being able to introduce David Bradley. David is the Chief Executive Officer of the National Community Action Foundation. He has been with that entity since the early 1980s, essentially saved community action agencies with a piece of legislation called the Community Services Block Grant that funds community action agencies like mine. David is a miracle worker when it comes to the legislative process. David is a lawyer, I think, by education. He is a former Small Business Administration Congressional Affairs staffer and then went to the National Community Action Foundation. More than any single person in this country, David Bradley is a guy who I can give credit to for the Community Action Committee of the Lehigh Valley existing today. He came in at a time when it was under threat, saved it, and has protected it for all these years. Republican presidents over and over have zeroed out funding in their budget proposals, and he's always had the money put back in, and sometimes even with significant increases, most recent of which, he got $1 billion added to the network of 1,000 community action agencies in the stimulus, the CARES Act, which is really an incredible trick that he pulled. So community action agencies cover about 98% of the country. So you think about community action agencies all over the country still being in business because of David Bradley. That's the impact this man has had. David, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Alan. I look forward to spending a few minutes with you. Thank you very much.
You've always had and shown a deep respect for the institution that is the United States Congress. Where did you get that? Is that your upbringing? Was that a college? Was there an epiphany somewhere along the way? How did you develop that respect for the institution of Congress?
Well, I think it my college education, both undergraduate and graduate, focused on the U.S. Congress. Second, at a fairly young age, I was at SBA in the Carter administration, and I worked with Congress. And I worked with Congress in the late 70s, early 1980s, when Congress was really, really fun and enjoyable to work with. There were giants in both the House and the Senate, professional staff that made careers of working for committees. And so it was really a terrific institution. The partisanship that we see today wasn't there. Members knew each other, and it was a club in a lot of ways, but people got along and they really tried to solve problems. That was when I became immersed in and just the value and how good the legislative process can be and how honorable people who work and serve in both the House and the Senate are. So all of that combined with a deep appreciation that Congress is a pretty remarkable institution.
You've worked with, I guess, 20 Congresses now, or almost 20 Congresses. How would you rank this Congress against past Congresses?
What's being considered in the rankings? If you look at collegiality, the ability of working across party lines, I'm involved with minor league baseball, as you know, and a lot of the Congress is batting below the Mendoza line. It's under 200. Partisanship is there, and it's every day that we're closer to the election, it gets worse, gets uglier. We did put that aside. You did see Congress put that aside in the first four coronavirus supplementals up to 3.5. But now Speaker Pelosi just unveiled the next one, which is going to be voted on in the House on Friday. I don't know a Republican is going to vote for it. And worse, I don't know Republicans, not one, has told me they've been consulted. So partisanship is back. The ability to move legislation in a bipartisan way is not very good in the House side, almost non-existent in the Senate side. So overall, I would give, on good days, Congress an incomplete. On most days, I would give Congress close to a failing grade.
And does it keep getting worse? I mean, is this one any better than the last one? Or is this them feeding off of each other's anger and distrust and everything? I mean, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. The one sort of complicating factor is President Trump. He dominates in the White House. President Trump does it even more. Just dominates the dialogue, dominates the discussion. Every day there seems to be a surprise or some kind of action from the White House that affects Congress. So that is, that's been a constant since 2017. What is, I think, the underreported story in Congress is how many members, but in both sides, both parties, really want to do the right thing. They Republicans may say, boy, we could break out from President Trump. We could, would support this, and this. But the threat of fundraising or being tweeted about, they shrink back. Democrats want to reach across party lines, but sometimes they're told, no, they can't. It's a strict party line. So the Congress today's Congress continues a path that unfortunately started 4 or 5 Congresses ago. I could even argue it started 10 Congresses ago, but not only isolated to this Congress. So it's a path that is not good for the country. But beneath all of that, beneath that surface, I hope it's a veneer, there are a lot of members, a lot of really good members, both parties, that given an opportunity, will do the right thing, will work bipartisan, will work on some very, very constructive solutions for the problems, the immense problems facing this country.
Does this Congress care about poor people?
Yes, I think they do. You clearly see the divide in between where Republicans are at and where. I think that if we ask the question, does Congress care about the poor? The answer is yes. Generally speaking, both parties don't agree on it. They'll agree that, we need to care about the poor, but they will not agree on what caring for the poor means. Look at the divide now between just on the issue of reopening, restarting the economy. There's Republicans, some Democrats I talked to as well, that view the best thing we can do for low-income communities is get the economy and get the businesses back up, get the hiring going, whereas Democrats may take a different view. But generally speaking, very small part of Congress that I would leave a meeting or a discussion thinking they don't care about the poor. The vast majority of Congress wants to do the right thing.
The stimulus. Do you think they did it? Was that an effective piece of legislation? I mean, from our perspective, getting the money from Community Services Block Grant, that was phenomenal. But there was a gazillion dollars for other things. Was that targeted effectively? Is that just a broad brush, you know, act of mercy? What was that?
Yeah, I think it was a chaotic to the extreme process, which a lot of members are trying to do the right thing and simply get money out the door, throw as many stickies on the wall or whatever. Yeah. But I think some mistakes were made. Number on both sides. Number one, I think the SBA programs, PPP and the disaster loans, was a incredibly successful program. The mistake was the president promised that it would be up and pretty much perfect within a week, $45 billion program dumped on an agency that normally does about $30 billion in loans in a year. So the agency, SBA, responded very, very well. Second, in the rush to provide a lifeline, which was needed, a lot of thought was given on exactly the outlines, the parameters, the rules of programs. So they left it to the administration with a little guidance from Congress, even though anyone in the country who paid any attention to the news would have seen this train coming. There were some in the administration that were completely flat-footed when it came time to implement those dollars. So that's the second point. Administration, some agencies have done very well, as I praised SBA. Some agencies have done very well. Other agencies are very, very slow in getting off. The third thing is, you're asking about what was called COVID-19 3.0, the CARES Act. That was necessary, but it was important only in totality, only if there were other packages as well. If that were the only package, it wouldn't have solved the trick. But it was necessary and it helped. The supplemental we're working on now is necessary. And at some point, all these are supplementals. At some point, Congress is going to have to deal with an actual stimulus bill as well to really jumpstart this economy moving again. So in isolation, they're necessary, but not the answer. Collectively, they're not only necessary, but they, I think, will help solve, go a long way down toward solving the problem.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. By day, night, weekends, my whole life, I run the Community Action Committee of Lehigh Valley. My guest right now is David Bradley, who has been the single person most responsible for keeping the American Community Action Agencies in business. And David, I thank you for that. I've always been amazed, you know, when I hear you talk. You're a name dropper, you know, because obviously you need to know people and have the relationships with them to get things done. I've heard you talk about your meetings with Nancy Pelosi and with Chuck Schumer and Steny Hoyer. One time, you know, I was with you in a meeting with Steny Hoyer, the House Majority Leader. Is there any member of Congress that you think is particularly effective at doing what they do?
Well, I pick one that I've alienated 35. I think that this class of 2018, in which you've got a new member from Lehigh Valley, I think the class of 2018 was a pretty darn good class in Congress. There's some Republicans in there, a lot of Democrats, but overall, I thought that they were a cut above in terms of, you know, people that have run for Congress in years past. I think the recruitment is very good on both. I can't pick out one. I look at a host of members and both Republican and Democrats, but So you can't focus just on one. There might be 25 that you're impressed with. But what is easy to do, particularly if you've been at the game for a while, what is easy to do is pick out rising stars. It's members that show up at the hearings, members that not only ask the questions that staff has prepared, that's easy to do, but it's the follow-up questions that they got to think about on their own and engage in those conversations. It's the kind of staff that they've hired to help them drive legislation, get it over the finish line. So there's all sorts of factors going into answering the question, who's the star? There are a number of stars, and they're starting to emerge. They're going to be part of leadership. They're going to be people who can succeed on passing bipartisan legislation, and you're going to look at members who others respect and will tell you, well, what's so-and-so to think about this? And they carry some gravitas. So there's a number of them. But there are stars in Congress, in both parties, that have not been recognized nationally yet, but they're coming.
Betty McCallum's of the world?
Betty McCallum is day in and day out one of the best friends this program has ever had. I view Senator Kennedy and Congressman Dave Obey and Senator Tom Harkin. But also, there are a number of senators who are Republicans who are very helpful. The Pennsylvania Republicans, I'm talking about in the House, that have, from your Charlie Dent to even Mike Kelly, Glenn Thompson, Mike and Brian Fitzpatrick. I can go over a whole list of Pennsylvania Republicans who've always been there for us. They don't do it because it gets them incredible political mileage, or that it makes it easy to oppose their Republican Party leadership. They did it because they believe in what's going on locally. And so you can look around, and I can identify best friends in both parties who have been there through thick and thin, and the spotlight isn't on them. And they're behind closed doors. They care about the program. And fortunately, for this program, it's both parties. And you take some satisfaction that if you view your relationship with Congress that I need them more than they need me, I want to make the relationships work, you don't hate the other side, you try to get problems solved, and if you go in with that as your approach, there is so much that unites the parties that enables them to support this program. Number one being they believe in communities, and they believe in helping those communities and supporting organizations that are essential in those communities. That's us. And if you do it in a bipartisan way, you can build pretty good coalitions, which makes $1 billion possible.
David, you've been uncanny in your ability to project what's going to happen in elections. Several years ago, you spoke at our annual meeting, and you upset, you upset one of the people in the room with your comments about what was going to happen in the election. He stormed out and said he would resign if what you predicted happened. Well, what you predicted happened exactly. And, of course, I called him the next day and said, so have you submitted your resignation yet? What do you expect to come out of this election?
Well, I expect the unexpected. Let me just put it as a safe comment. But we're still 5 months out or whatever. But a few predictions. One, I think the Democrats will control the House. They will retain the House. And they've had good recruitments. Their fundraising is very good. They've fallen short on some of their stars that they wanted on to recruit. So I think Democrats hold on. And do I think they'll increase? I think Republicans will pick up a few seats as of right now. Second, as of right now, and again, this is months out, this will be somewhat controversial, I do think the Democrats, for the first time, pick up the Senate. I've not, the highest I've been for the last 6 months is 50-50, which is not a waffle, but just looking at the races, the most likely outcome if it's 50-50 in the Senate, 51-49, and Trump's president, Trump is reelected, then not much changes. And I do think now that there's enough Senate races in play, a couple of sleeper races out there. I think the odds are, they've shifted, that Democrats will take the Senate. A couple of races to watch. Keep an eye on Michigan, Gary Peters' race, Alabama with Doug Jones, Democrat, who won in deep red Alabama. And another sleeper race out there to watch is North Carolina. So I think Democrats will, as of right now, pick up the Senate. In terms of the presidential, I think there's a couple of bombshells, a couple of things out there that will shock the electorate, and just a couple more developments on probably on both sides. So it's too early to say, but if I were Joe Biden, I certainly think you got to get out of the basement and get out there, figure out a way to break through just the bullhorn and the microphone that's at the White House. And if we have a second wave on this coronavirus, I think that voting in the fall is going to be a very, very challenging proposition. You may see some drastic changes in terms of voting patterns, what is allowed, what's not, mail-in voting, et cetera. And I think that that's going to be that's going to be something that the democracy has to watch very, very carefully. So too early to say on the White House. There's a path that Trump could win. There's a path, a little wider path that Biden can win, but still too many uncertainties. The path that the Senate is on now is that Chuck Schumer will be majority leader and Nancy Pelosi will continue as speaker.
Joe Biden promised to appoint choose a woman to be the vice president. I thought that was going to happen weeks ago. What do you got in terms of a prediction for who Biden's going to pick? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, they're certainly thinking he will. I got a couple of dark horses I'll mention, but the names that you certainly hear from Democratic members and people that claim they're close to Joe Biden, I'm not. People that claim they're part of Biden's inner circle. And I found that the people who are claiming they're part of Biden's inner circle multiplied by, I think, 20 once he won South Carolina. I didn't realize the inner circle was that large. Hmm. It was very small when he was close to dropping out. But I think Kamala Harris and Klobuchar are real. I tend to think that it probably wouldn't go Elizabeth Warren. Couple of dark horses to keep, long shots to keep an eye on. I think Grisham in New Mexico, the governor, is one. Val Demings from Florida, former police chief. She was part of the White House, part of the House Democrats impeachment team on the Senate. She's impressive.
Yeah.
African American lady. She is impressive.
Yeah,
and I've been around her a number of times. Wow, you can see her as vice president. And there's two or three others out there, but I think in the end that's going to be the series. You hear Michigan with that governor. and I think Whitmer, but I think that there's there's 10 that are being mentioned, but I think you can break it down into 5 and 5. So I'd be comfortable. I think any of the 5 that I mentioned, or 6, whatever it was, would be qualified to be vice president and qualified to be president, because there is a widespread expectation that Biden will take a pledge to only serve one term.
Biden makes me nervous, David. His inability to kind of get it right when he talks really scares me. I'm expecting that he would want some, not just of the geopolitical balance and the gender diversity balance, but I think also the ideological balance. I mean, he is a pretty moderate Democrat. So I kind of think that, you know, Elizabeth Warren makes some sense, maybe Kamala Harris. But, I mean, do you think that ideological balance is a factor or not?
I think the ability to get along as well is important. But the question you raise is, does he have to go left to pick up someone from the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing of the party? He would if the desire to vote for anybody that can beat Trump was not so high. You know, he's in the Midwest, Klobuchar is helpful. Kamala Harris, Biden's going to carry California. Well, that means Florida's going to be in play. Michigan would be in play. So there's a number of scenarios. I just don't know. Warren is 70. Biden, I think, is 78 or 77. Warren is 70. I don't know how you build the bench strength on that. I think he goes younger, and certainly there are pretty good choices out there to, you know, appeal to independents is where the battleground's going to be, and not get boxed into being, you know, far left. Although I would say one thing is that this coronavirus has certainly made healthcare front and center. It ought to be. And second, Biden in a basement and Trump at the White House. We're not seeing the debate on foreign policy. We're not seeing the debate on trade, international relations. That, I think, by November may be a fairly significant issue, bringing our supplies, our pipeline back on shore. And Biden, if he wanted a bold look, might look at a Susan Rice. I don't think he will, but he might look at somebody with some foreign policy, international experience. I don't think it'll be Michelle Obama and some of the other names you hear, the celebrity names. I think he's got to look at his term, who can help him now, but also who's going to be ready to step in if, God forbid, they need to in the first term, or if Biden doesn't run for a second term, who's going to be help develop that bench strength in the next generation of Democratic leaders.
We in the introduction, David, I've only got barely a minute left. In the introduction, I didn't mention the fact that you have ownership in a number of minor league baseball teams. You and I are big baseball fans. The big question in my life these days is, are we going to have a baseball season this year?
I think you're going to have a major league season. I think you will not have a minor league season this year. And I really don't think you're going to see fans at major league games, or if you do, they're going to be in 10% of what you would normally expect at a game. But I do think there'll be a season for Major League, 82 games.
Well, if I can see one game, it's better than none. So,
David
Bradley, National Community Action Foundation, good friend for many years, incredible lobbyist. Thanks for saving community action agencies. We've run out of time, David. Thanks very much for joining me. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. Thanks for joining us.